Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Paul Henley. Welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, live from London. First up today, Israel says it's expanded its military operations in Lebanon today against Hezbollah, moving into a new zone in the southwest of the country. Earlier, a military spokesman said another leading member of Hezbollah had been killed in an airstrike on Beirut. Hezbollah's current deputy leader, Naim Qassem, made a statement supporting a call from Lebanon's parliament for a ceasefire. It's thought to be the first time Hezbollah has voiced this without tying it to a truce in Gaza. International bodies continue to call for restraint. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, warned today of the danger that the conflict could engulf the region.
I've warned for months of the risks of the conflict spreading. And the Middle East is a powder keg with many parties holding the match. The situation in the occupied West Bank is boiling over. And now in Lebanon, attacks including on civilians are threatening the entire region. Over the last few days, exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and others in Lebanon and the Israel Defense Forces have intensified across the Blue Line in total disregard of Security Council Resolutions 1701 and 1559.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has directly addressed the Lebanese people. In a pre-recorded video message, Mr. Netanyahu said his country's military had killed the would-be successors of Hezbollah's late leader Hassan Nasrallah, and he urged the Lebanese people to rise up against Hezbollah or risk the destruction of their country.
Don't let these terrorists destroy your future any more than they've already done. Stand up and take your country back. You have an opportunity that hasn't existed in decades. An opportunity to take care of the future of your children and grandchildren. You have an opportunity to save Lebanon before it falls into the abyss of a long war that will lead to destruction and suffering like we see in Gaza.
Ugo Bashega is our correspondent in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. I spoke to him shortly before we came on air, and I asked him first about Hezbollah's deputy leader, Naim Qassem, signalling his apparent willingness to talk about a ceasefire.
For the first time, he made no mention of a pause in hostilities in Gaza as a precondition. You know, for the past year, Hezbollah has been saying that these attacks on Israel are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So he said he was supporting the initiative of the Lebanese parliament to try to secure a ceasefire in this conflict. But again, he didn't mention Gaza. Some people are, you know, interpreting these comments as being a suggestion that Hezbollah could support a ceasefire in this conflict. I mean, having said that, if you look from an Israeli perspective, they've got no reason to agree to any kind of ceasefire here because they've been extremely successful so far in degrading Hezbollah, in eliminating the leadership of the group. Naim Qassem is pretty much the only top member of Hezbollah that remains alive, and they've managed to destroy the infrastructure that has been built by Hezbollah across the country. And I think, you know, they've been so successful that many believe that this is the opportunity to weaken Hezbollah even further.
And the reported killing of the man assumed to have taken over as leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, can you tell us about that?
This has been the speculation for a few days. There was a massive attack here in Beirut last week, and the IDF this morning said that they believe that Hashim Salfiyadin, who was believed to be the successor of Hassan Nasrallah, had been killed in that attack. The Israeli Prime Minister now, Benjamin Netanyahu, confirming that information. We haven't had confirmation from Hezbollah yet. Again, it was a major attack that happened happened here in Beirut. And I think, again, going back to the point of the Israelis being extremely successful in this campaign against Hezbollah, they're trying to destroy not only Hezbollah's present, but also its future. So they've managed to assassinate the top leadership of the group. And now, if you like, they're going through other senior members who could emerge as possible new leaders of Hezbollah.
And meanwhile, they're also expanding the ground war. What's the latest today?
What we're seeing here are new indications that this offensive is not going to stop anytime soon. So today, the Israeli military announced that troops will be moved into a part of southwest Lebanon. So this is a new area of the country where this ground invasion is happening. We've seen that in the southeast of the country, the Israeli military has been advancing. They've been conducting those ground operations near the border. Yesterday, they warned people to stay away from a stretch of the Lebanese coast, saying that they would start attacking Hezbollah from the sea. And here in Beirut and across the country, those airstrikes continue. The Lebanese government said that in the last 24 hours, they recorded 137 airstrikes across the country. So that gives you a sense of the intensity of this air campaign as this ground invasion continues.
We heard a message from the Israeli Prime Minister aimed directly at the Lebanese people today. Rise up, he said, against Hezbollah. How will that be received where you are?
I mean, this is a country full of divisions, and a lot of people here, even people who are against Hezbollah, who are critical of Hezbollah, who disagree with what Hezbollah has been doing, they say that what is happening here is not a war by the Israeli military against Hezbollah, but it is a war against Lebanon. Many people here believe that the entire country is under attack, not only Hezbollah. They talk about the civilian infrastructure that has been hit. They talk about the attacks on rescue workers, medical teams that have been happening over the last few weeks. So I think it's very difficult to see how a message coming from Israel can resonate in this country right now.
Ugo Bashega. So after a year of the war in Gaza, with Israel's operations in Lebanon intensifying, and with what seems to be an inevitable Israeli response to the Iranian missile attack last week, many are asking where this conflict is heading now. Towards the end of this programme, we'll be assessing prospects for any kind of peace in conversation with former Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. For now, our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, hears from young Palestinians and Israelis on whether they think there is a chance of putting aside the hatred.
In a very turbulent place, I'm in actually quite a peaceful spot right now, which is the main park in the middle of Jerusalem. And I've come here to talk to young soldiers about how they see what's happened and how it might affect their future as Israelis. And so I've joined Sally, Oz and Shlomo, who've all served in different ways in the last year in the Israeli military.
We don't know. We don't have any uncertainty in terms of what the war is going to be look like in 1 year with Gazans and the hostages. So it's just a big question mark about everything surrounding our lives.
Can you have a better life when you are at war with some of your neighbors, your Arab neighbors?
What can we do else? What can we do? What can be done? We have the right to exist. We're not going to go anywhere. They have the right to exist. They're not going to go anywhere.
We can't afford an enemy on our borders that work in trying to destroy us and to kill us. That's their mission. That's their job. We can't afford it.
So your message is you can't trust the neighbors?
Not in the meantime.
I think that it's just more complicated than that. I think that it's just very, very hard for us to say he has to be innocent. It's just really, 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 I would say, unnatural for Israelis now to say that there are some innocents over there that don't support Hamas, that don't support what happened on October 7th. We've experienced a national trauma. We're still healing.
So, I mean, they too go through a massive trauma.
I know. I'm saying that both sides are tragically been hurt, but we're still healing, and we can't just play with our lives like that anymore. We just can't.
There is no trust. I think this is for sure, right? Like, it's not even a conversation. But it's also about how we talk about morality and how we talk about war. I feel that right now Israel is kind of like stuck in the middle with a Western world that doesn't really know how to talk about war. Because war is always a bad thing. It's always something that you can decide not to have. It's always something that it's up to you as a Western country. And you can just decide to have peace. As if you can just decide to have a relationship with someone.
The world thinks we have two options, to go to the war or to sign a ceasefire or a peace agreement. I'm sorry to say that we have two options, a very bad war right now or much worse war in the future.
What about Palestinian choices? We travel to Nablus, a Palestinian city in the West Bank that is proud of its reputation as a stronghold of opposition to the Israeli occupation.
How are you doing?
At Seeds, a community organization, we met its director, Rai Dibi, a supporter of the two-state solution, and two young activists, Zaid and Yasmin.
The international community shown very big solidarity with the people of Ukraine. And from the very first moment, they denounced 7th of October. But we didn't see the same international community denounce where we are the main victims and where the international community, instead of having a rendezvous with the courage, they prefer to stay in the comfort zone where our people are dying every day.
How do you see the future?
Very blurred. You cannot see it. It's very gloomy because you don't really know what will happen in the next hour, not in the next week, but in the next hour. You don't know what will happen.
We spoke to some young Israelis, similar ages, 20s, to you guys. And they said, look, we cannot trust the Palestinians after the 7th of October. What's your response?
I would say the same, because after what they did with the 7th of October, the killing of the Palestinian in Gaza, and also not Gaza, in the West Bank also, getting Palestinians, kids being shot in their heads, elderly people, women, having walking the checkpoints and then being killed. All I can say that I can think the same. I cannot trust an Israeli, especially IDF.
So when you hear the Israelis saying they follow international law, they respect the laws of war, you don't believe them?
Actually, no, I don't believe. It's a horror movie and it's like not stopped, because we also see like how is the Israeli occupation attacked the Palestinian in Gaza, how they bombed the hospital, the families, the kids. They don't have any red lines.
We are losing a full Palestinian generation. When a whole generation lose the hope, the international community should take care about this. Because if this generation lose the hope in peace and in the two-state solution, the consequences will be international, regional, not just in the Palestinian local level.
Young Palestinians talking to Jeremy Bowen, and at 23 hours here on the BBC World Service, World Debate is asking, 1 year on from the start of the war, is there a pathway to peace in the Middle East? You're listening to the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Coming up.
If you're out walking your dog after dark, it's worth looking up at it, because who doesn't want to make a wish on one? So if you've got clear skies, go out and take a look, because it's going to be peaking tonight.
Perhaps you could catch a glimpse of a shooting star tonight with an annual show set to light up the skies of the Northern Hemisphere. The headlines: Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country's military has killed the successor to Hezbollah's late leader Hassan Nasrallah. But Israel's military says it's still trying to confirm the results of the airstrike. President Biden says a hurricane expected to hit Florida on Wednesday could be the state's worst storm in 100 years. And Mexico's new president has announced plans to tackle organized crime, focusing on intelligence gathering and the finances of drug cartels. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. It's the phone call that many scientists dream of getting, and today it went to Geoffrey Hinton. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences rang him to tell him he had won the Nobel Prize for Physics. The Canadian-British researcher is known as a pioneer in developing machine learning, which has become a foundation for artificial intelligence. He's also an outspoken critic of the dangers posed by artificial intelligence. My colleague Celia Hatton spoke to Professor Hinton and asked him first about that call.
My phone went off at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and it was a call from Sweden saying I won the Nobel Prize in Physics. And my first thought was, how do I know this isn't a spoof call? Because I wasn't expecting this. I never expected to win the Nobel Prize in Physics.
And what does this mean to you?
It means a lot. In particular, it means that people will take my warnings about AI safety more seriously.
Tell us about your work. I want to talk about AI and your feelings about artificial intelligence, but just tell us about the work that won you the prize.
According to what they said in their press conference, it was for two pieces of work. One was work with Terry Sanofsky on something called Boltzmann machines that was showing how to take things called Hopfield nets, which are a kind of neural network, and make them able to learn more complicated things. And Terry and I came up with a very neat algorithm. But that's not what led to the big engineering breakthroughs. So I also did work with another of my mentors called David Rummelhart, who died very young of a nasty brain disease, on something called backpropagation. And backpropagation is a learning procedure that's used in all the neural networks now. And that's what's allowed us to build these great big chatbots.
You've talked a lot about your work and how it's fed into sort of the wider world around artificial intelligence. I wonder if you can tell us, you know, about your safety concerns regarding AI.
So probably sometime in the next 20 years, we'll be able to build things more intelligent than ourselves. And we've never been there before. We have no idea what that's going to be like. Most people can't really imagine it. And a worry I have, and many other researchers have, is that if we build things more intelligent than ourselves, what's to stop them taking over? And of course, what we really care about people. We're people, and what we care about is people. So we'd rather stay in control. But we don't know how to do that. And so we need young researchers to be, with flexible minds, to be working on that problem right now to make sure we can stay in control. And we need governments to force the big companies to provide them the resources they need. So if you look at what's happened with OpenAI, initially they were very concerned about safety, but now they're much more concerned with profits, and most of their safety researchers have left. And that's a bad thing for the long-term future of humanity.
You mentioned big companies, and I must mention that you also worked at Google for a decade. You left Google so that you could speak out more widely. Are people listening to you now?
Yes, they are. I was impressed by the fact that governments did listen. We still don't know exactly what to do. It's not like climate change. With climate change, we know exactly what to do, which is stop burning carbon. It's just the big oil companies don't want to do that. With this, we don't really know how to ensure we stay in control.
You're dubbed one of the pioneers in artificial intelligence, and you don't feel that you know how to control it?
Once it gets more intelligent than us, I don't feel we know how to be sure we can control it. So that's an urgent research topic.
Just to circle back, now that you've won this prize, do you think it will embolden you more? Will it give you more of a platform to speak about this?
I was pretty bold anyway, I think, but it will make people take me more seriously, I think.
And how are you going to celebrate?
I'm going to try and get some sleep. It's the middle of the night here.
University of Toronto Professor Geoffrey Hinton, who shared that Nobel Prize with the American researcher John Hopfield. Two mountaineers in the high Himalayas had a fortunate escape, having been stranded at more than 20,000 feet. American Michelle Dvorak and Brit Faye Manners were nearing the peak of Chaukamba Mountain in northern India when the rope carrying their food, tent and equipment snapped in a storm. Faye Manners, now safely down the mountain, told me about the moment they realised they were in trouble.
On the end of the rope was our haul bag full of all of our safety equipment and climbing equipment that we would need to be able to retreat from the mountain that we were on. So I was pretty horrified.
No food, no water, and that's crucial because everything was frozen and you didn't have a stove to melt ice. What did you do?
Well, to get water, we waited till the next day, and we started to look on the rock and see where there would be ice that would potentially be melting in the sun, so that we could somehow put our water bottles underneath some drips and try and essentially just get a few mouthfuls of water just to keep us a little bit hydrated.
You had one sleeping bag, is that right? Between two of you, I mean.
We did, but actually it was a double sleeping bag. So luckily we could both fit in it quite comfortably.
And did you stay warm enough?
I was close to hypothermia. Michelle was warmer than me, mainly because the bag that we dropped, it had all of my warm clothes in it. Whereas the other bag that we had, had some of Michelle's warmer clothes in it. So it was Michelle's job to try and keep me warm.
Just describe that moment when you were abseiling down and you were kind of losing hope. Can you just go in, what were your prospects then?
Yeah, Michelle and I had been discussing all of the different options that we would have, and one of the options, for example, was that because we only had one pair of crampons and one pair of ice axes, that one of us would have to leave and try to go down this crevassed glacier alone, which would have been dangerous in itself, and the other person would stay and keep the sleeping bag and hope for the best. That was one of our options, which neither of us particularly liked because we didn't want to leave each other. We really wanted to avoid getting to this crevassed glacier that was really steep, where we didn't have our full equipment to be able to cross it safely. But if the rescue had not come, then essentially we would have been forced to have tried that method to get back to the base camp. But I don't think we would have had very high chances.
What stage did you know that your emergency call had worked? A helicopter came at one point, didn't it?
Yes, well, on the first day, the helicopter couldn't come because there was extreme fog, and we knew that there'd be no visibility for the helicopters to fly. But actually, the next morning, we did see two helicopters fly around searching for us. Unfortunately, they couldn't see us.
So tell us about the point when rescue did come.
So when rescue came, it was actually on the third day. So we'd already been waiting quite a while. And at this point, we were extremely worried for our health. And we kind of lost hope that the rescue was going to be able to find us. But on the third day, as we were retreating ourselves and abseiling down the mountain, luckily, we actually had three French climbers, that had been alerted and were in the nearby mountains and had decided to take it upon themselves to try and come to our rescue. And at that point was when I really felt the relief that we might be okay, that there was someone else out there that was able to help us.
How did you react?
I started crying, and Michelle had said that she's never seen me cry before. I think it was just I'd been stressed for so long and trying to be really practical about how we can survive, that when they finally got there and I realised that, you know, there was someone else that was going to help us and there might be a chance that we can survive, it was almost like I was allowed to be emotional. So I started crying. I was really happy.
British mountaineer Faye Manners. This is NewsHour on the World Service.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
geothermal energy has seen sluggish growth rates in comparison to other renewables, such as solar and wind power. It's expensive to develop sources of underground heat, and even when they work, projects usually offer a low return on investment. Now, though, new technology developed by a company in Germany could make geothermal much more profitable. The host of the Climate Question podcast, Greer Jackson, went to Germany to see how they did it.
Christian Freitag shows me a bunch of shipping containers stacked on top of each other. Wires, pipes and shiny steel scaffolding connect them all together, framing the blue and cloudless sky above us.
So typically at a geothermal plant, you suck up that hot water and that steam, you extract the heat, and then you plug it back down into the ground again. But you've got an extra step in the process where you extract lithium from the geothermal waters or brines.
That's correct. This salty water has been down there for millions of years. And one of these salts is lithium chloride. This is a very valuable product for the battery materials and car manufacturing industry.
How valuable is it?
So if you look at our project, we are of course selling power and heat, but the main contribution to our revenues comes indeed from the lithium. It's more than 80%.
Wow!
Yeah, and that's by producing a critical raw material and at the same time providing renewable, sustainable heat and power to the nearby communities is such an ideal combination. It's really a win-win situation.
It is a win-win situation, yes. But really, the win comes from the lithium. Geothermal power alone isn't all that profitable. But if you extract lithium, this critical metal, you can make some real money. In fact, Vulcan Energy Resources have pre-sold all their lithium for nearly the next decade.
This is a demonstration plant and very, very similar to the commercial plant that we are going to build. There we will produce 24,000 tons of lithium a year. And to put that in perspective, that will be good for around about 500,000 electric cars per year.
So basically you'll be able to provide all the lithium for the German car market?
If you will.
We've just opened two double doors to see three sort of metal vats similar to what you would see in beer breweries.
We are standing right in front of the core of everything. It's like three vessels which are filled with the filter media, if you will. We call it sorbent. And this sorbent filters or extracts the lithium out of the brine.
Can I think of this a bit like a water filter or a sponge that absorbs the lithium but nothing else?
Yeah, you can. It's a purely physical process. Unfortunately, I can't show you the lithium chloride, but I can show you a container which is filled with water. And believe me, there's lithium in there. And there's a lot of value in that container, as much as 10,000 euros.
And you've just got it out here on display. It's not even locked up. It's outside.
Yeah, well, try to carry it away.
Yes, that's a good point.
Geothermal has a huge upfront cost, but maybe extracting lithium from the hot water could make it much more profitable and much more attractive to investors and energy companies, as the return on investment is much faster and doesn't rely on public funding as much.
That was the BBC's Greer Jackson reporting from Germany. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Hurricane Milton, centred near Mexico's northeastern coast and heading for the American state of Florida, is decreasing in intensity but growing in size. Hundreds of thousands of people are heeding warnings to get out of its way. President Biden's postponed a planned trip abroad so he can oversee preparations for the storm making landfall on Wednesday. Speaking from the White House, Mr. Biden said he'd offered local leaders in Florida federal assistance should they need it. The president urged people who'd been ordered to evacuate to leave immediately.
The current path of the storm restricted the Tampa Bay area and cut directly across the state, with the potential for this storm to both enter Florida as a hurricane and leave Florida as a hurricane on the Atlantic coast. This could be the worst storm to hit Florida in over a century.
So the warnings are dire. What effect are they having? To find out more, I spoke to Tampa Bay Times reporter Kirby Wilson.
Luckily, people are heeding the warnings in large part. We often fear at the local newspaper that people won't leave when they're told to, because Florida and specifically the Tampa Bay region hasn't seen a direct hit from a hurricane in more than 100 years. And so we often are warned that this is the big one. And when those warnings don't come exactly to fruition, it sort of erodes people's confidence in those projections. But just 10 days ago, the Tampa Bay region was walloped by the storm surge from Hurricane Helene. And so as a result, people know how serious hurricanes can be. They've seen their neighbors flooded. A lot of them flooded themselves. And a lot of people are packing up and leaving.
Yes. And when they know that 200 people died further up the coast, mostly in North Carolina, it's an effective warning, isn't it? Some local leaders are saying, get out or die. It's as stark as that.
Absolutely. And in Pinellas County, which some models have as the epicenter of landfall, more than a dozen people died from the storm surge in Helene. And that was, as you say, hundreds of miles from the very worst of it. So, there's certainly some direct knowledge about the worst effects that we can see.
So what does lots of people heeding the warning look like, Kirby?
Well, if you are just starting your preparations now, it's very unpleasant. It means that if you're trying to get out of town, the roads, there's massive traffic jams basically all over the western part of Florida. Supplies are low, gasoline, things like that, bottled water at grocery stores. A lot of grocery stores have actually closed at this point. And so there's a lot of sort of, if you're trying to prepare at the last minute, you may be out of luck. But a lot of people have prepared, and it just means they're hunkering down or they've settled at the place that they've moved to. It also means filling emergency shelters that are sort of official, official sites set up by governments, schools, gymnasia, things like that.
And that's where people are moving to, is it?
A lot of people move to family members. I actually moved a little inland to stay with my mom. I'm from here, and so my mother's still here, and I'm with her. But a lot of people moved north in the state or took a flight out earlier in the week. But certainly for the people that want to stay close to their homes, an emergency shelter is a good option and a cheap option.
And when is the storm finally expected to be there?
It's expected to make landfall late Wednesday night, probably around 10 or 11 p.m. local time, which is very worrisome. Just like Helene, it means that the worst of the storm surge is going to happen overnight. And anybody who made the unfortunate decision not to leave, or if the storm, really does bring 15 feet of surge from the coast, even some places that that may not have been expecting flooding may get it maybe in the middle of the night, and it's going to be a horrible situation.
That was Tampa Bay Times reporter Kirby Wilson. 5 years on from the Indian Prime Minister stripping Kashmir of its regional autonomy, a pro-independence party has emerged as the winner of the first legislative elections there. The Jammu and Kashmir National Conference won nearly half the seats and will team up with Congress, the main opposition to Narendra Modi's national government. The BBC's Raghavendra Rao is in the city of Srinagar in Kashmir covering the elections, and I asked him first how significant they'd been.
Pretty significant, because Jammu and Kashmir has not had a state government. I mean, the people have not had their own elective representatives since 2018. The last time assembly elections were held here, that was in 2014. And the government, which was formed at that time, it could barely last 4 years. And then it collapsed. And in the following year, that is 2019, the Indian federal government stripped Jammu and Kashmir of its special status, which provided, the state with a fair amount of autonomy. And post that, Jammu and Kashmir, it's being run by the federal government itself. So people, they were feeling a bit suffocated in the sense that they felt that they did not have their own elected representatives to take up their issues and solve them. And in that sense, these elections were something the people here were eagerly waiting for. And when the elections did happen, they turned out in good numbers to vote. And the sense now is that, people are really looking forward to having their own government and their own elected representatives in the assembly soon.
And how much influence can this new coalition have? How much can it stand up to oppose the Indian government?
If you remember, when the autonomy was taken away from Jammu and Kashmir, the state was stripped also of its statehood. It was divided into two federally administered territories. And ever since, the central government or the federal government in India, they have been running the show here. Now, the big question is that when will the statehood for Jammu and Kashmir be restored? Now, that is the big question on everybody's mind, because till that happens, the center, the federal government, will continue to exercise significant authority and a significant say in the day-to-day affairs of governance and administration here. And the next big thing here to look forward to is whether the statehood of Jammu and Kashmir is restored anytime soon or not.
Because security in the region has long been a concern, especially since past elections have been marred by violence. These ones were relatively peaceful, weren't they?
Well, absolutely. And this is something for which, you know, India's federal government takes a lot of credit for. And they say that after stripping Jammu and Kashmir of its autonomy, they have been able to manage affairs better here. And they cite data to buttress their claims that violence has indeed come down in some areas. But on the other hand, you know, some areas which were untouched by violence in the past have seen spates of violence in the recent months. But yes, the elections were relatively peaceful. No major violence, no major incidents were reported. And it remains to be seen, I mean, the kind of powers this new government here will have when it comes to running the security affairs, because as things stand right now, the center is going to have a lot of say in managing the security situation as well.
The BBC's Raghavendra Rao speaking to me there from Srinagar in Kashmir. If you're in the northern hemisphere and your view of the sky isn't spoilt by too many clouds in the next 24 hours, you might be able to spot more than a few meteors. The annual Draconid meteor shower is currently at its peak, visible shortly after sunset today and tomorrow. I've been talking about it with the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, Professor Catherine Haymans.
What's happening right now is the Earth is travelling through a stream of debris that was left over by a comet that passed through this part of the solar system about 5 years ago, leaving lots of stuff behind it. And that debris burns up in our atmosphere, and that's what creates those bright shooting stars across our night sky.
So shooting stars is actually a complete misnomer.
Yeah, they're not stars.
They're bits of debris from a shattered comet. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So as the comet comes into our solar system from the outer edges, it comes from sort of past Jupiter all the way in, pulled in by the gravity of the sun. And that, as it comes in towards the sun, it heats up just slightly and so sheds some of the material on it, on its path towards the sun.
I mean, the fact that these come round once a year suggests, I mean, not to do Christmas down, but they're not that special. I mean, is it that big a deal?
Well, everyone loves to wish on a shooting star, Paul. The Draconis, yeah, it's a meteor shower that you see every year. The frequency of the shooting stars with this particular meteor shower aren't that often, roughly one every 10 to 20 minutes. So if you're out walking your dog after dark, it's worth looking up at it. And sometimes the meteor showers like the Perseids and the Leonids at different times of the year, but then we see these shooting stars more like one every few minutes. But it's still gorgeous to look at. So if you've got clear skies, go out and take a look, because it's going to be peaking tonight.
Take a look, we should underline, if you're in the northern hemisphere. What, anywhere in the northern hemisphere, provided there's no significant cloud cover?
Exactly, yeah. So these meteors, they come out of a constellation called Draco, hence the Draconids, which is just above the Big Dipper. So if you're used to seeing the constellation the Plough, then if you follow the spoon bit and then go from the bottom of the spoon up, and you'll find the constellation of Draco, which looks like a dragon. And that's where these shooting stars appear to sort of come out from. But basically just look north, and if get somewhere dark, get away from the streetlights, and that gives you your best chance of seeing what's going on in our solar system.
If people miss this meteor shower, as you will in Edinburgh, because it's very cloudy as usual,
yeah,
what others can we look forward to?
Yeah, so if you're particularly excited about meteor showers, you've got the Orionids coming up on the 21st and 22nd of October, and that's when the Earth is ploughing through the debris left over by Comet Halley, which is one of the famous comets. But if you want something sooner than that, astronomers are getting extremely excited because there is a new comet in our solar system. My friends in the Southern Hemisphere have been sending me photographs of it for the last week or so. And it's coming round for people in the Northern Hemisphere to see from about the 12th of October onwards. So after sunset, there'll be 10-15 minutes where you can see this comet, we hope, before it sets. You never really know with comets whether it's going to be brighter or fainter than it changes its brightness. But we're hopeful that at least with a pair of binoculars, you'll be able to see this comet, which is known as Comet Chuchunshang.
That was the Astronomer Royal for Scotland, Professor Catherine Haymans. It's time for a quick reminder. You can listen to NewsHour whenever you like. We've got two editions a day. You can find the latest online at bbcworldservice.com, or you can sign up for a free podcast of the programme, released twice a day, of course. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. The two-state solution, Israel alongside a sovereign Palestinian nation, is a proposal still held up by many as the only option for peace in the Middle East. Yossi Beilin, who as Israeli Justice Minister helped to initiate the Oslo Peace Accords between Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1990s, is one of those people. Jonathan Kotab is an international human rights attorney who was on the Palestinian legal team for the Oslo Accords. He no longer sees a two-state solution as viable. NewsHour's James Kumarasamy spoke to both veteran negotiators earlier, and he started by asking Mr. Kotab about his vision for peace.
I think the old paradigms have been broken down. And the reason why they have is because Israel has persistently put obstacles before the two-state solution. While occasionally mouthing the words two states, they have been very busy putting up settlements, putting up obstacles, creating new facts on the ground to the point where it's no longer feasible to do a two-state solution. And also, there's something else that needs to be thought about, which is that we really need to think in new terms. And I think fresh thinking requires that we also reconsider the idea of two states and see if people can live together rather than be separated from one another.
But live together in what single state? An Israeli state? A Palestinian state? Surely neither side will accept that.
Live together in a pluralistic state that addresses the needs and concerns of both sides. This myth that Jews and Arabs can't live together is a myth. For about 13 centuries, Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived more or less in peace. I think the idea of having a separate Jewish state and a separate Arab state vying for the same territory is a zero-sum solution. So we need to move beyond that into a state that is pluralistic, that has justice, equality, and allows both peoples to thrive on the basis of equality rather than hatred and bitterness and separation.
Yossi Beilin, what do you make of that idea?
No way. No way, it will never happen. What may happen, this is what I'm trying to promote in the last 10 years with my partner, Dr. Hiba Husseini, is the idea of an Israeli-Palestinian confederation, a confederation of two sovereign and independent states, which will live side by side with a high level of cooperation. I think that speaking about one democratic state is totally, I mean, people like myself will fight in the streets against it, because I don't want to give up on the UN Resolution 181 from 1947, which accepted the idea of a Jewish state side by side with an Arab state. And to think that after so many years, a state which was recognized by the UN and by the whole world should disappear and become part of another state is something which is a total delusion, or if you want, an illusion, but it is not realistic and will not happen.
Jonathan Kitab, if you can't get people like Yossi Beilin on board, it's just a non-starter, isn't it, your idea?
Not really. I know it looks difficult at this point, but so is the two-state solution. That looks difficult at this point. That looks impossible, in fact, at this point, because it would require such an uprooting of about 700,000 or 800,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank. It would require removing what Israel has been building for decades, which is an apartheid system that treats Jews and non-Jews separately and differently. I'm sure that it feels impossible at the time. Just like ending apartheid in South Africa appeared impossible, ending slavery in the United States, ending colonialism and imperialism, providing equality, even between men and women, appeared totally impossible at the time. But eventually it happened. And what I'm saying is, when we fail, when the old ideas fail, we must be open to new ideas, however difficult they may appear.
Do you see partners for peace on the other side? Both of you. Yossi, first of all.
I see partners on the other side. I have partners on the other side. I meet them, even in such days. And I think that, first of all, the Palestinian president is somebody like that. He wants peace. He fought for peace. And although he is not becoming younger, unlike us, and although he is not becoming more popular, he is still one of the founding fathers. And if he signs a peace treaty with Israel, it will be respected in the Palestinian world, in the Arab world, and in the world at large. On the Israeli side, regretfully, right now, you don't have a partner, because Netanyahu is not a partner for peace. And we will have to do whatever we can in order, using the democratic tools, to shorten the term of this government.
Jonathan, is that how you see it? That while Benjamin Netanyahu is in post, the Palestinians don't have a partner?
Well, the very sad thing is that Netanyahu's position is shared by the majority of Israelis, that they do support his war on Gaza and his war on Lebanon, and in fact, his intended war beyond that on Iran. I do not see the numbers there in terms of an Israeli government that's willing to provide Palestinians with the very bare minimum of the two-state solution. And as long as they have the massive support of the United States, Britain, and some other Western countries, they think they can prevail.
So where does your idea of this single state, how does that come into being?
I wish the outside partners would at least stop interfering, stop providing not only weapons, but diplomatic cover. Somehow the outside forces are not part of the solution. They are part of the problem. I think it is possible to think, to envision, and to dream of a new reality that is a better one, both for Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs.
Jonathan Kitab and Yossi Beilin speaking to James Kumarasamy. That was NewsHour for Tuesday evening, UK time. Thank you very much for listening.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.